Hi everyone, my name is Kirk Bachman and welcome back to The Ultimate Dish. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with the remarkable Sherry Bair, founder and president of Bair Public Relations, the host of and producer of All in the Industry podcast, and writer and author of Chefwise, Life Lessons from Leading Chefs Around the World. Sherry's journey spans over three decades in the industry, beginning with her impactful tenure on the floors of Charlie Trotter's iconic restaurant in Chicago, Illinois. In the early 2000s, she took leap and established Bair Public Relations, where she currently represents a suite of restaurants, chefs, and culinary-focused clients. In spring 2023, Sherry achieved a huge milestone with the publication of her first book, Chefwise, Life Lessons from Leading Chefs Around the World. Sherry's passion for the culinary world is further exemplified by her roles as a former president of the New York Women's Culinary Alliance and her longstanding membership in La Dame's D'Escoffier in New York since 2010, where she serves as a committee co-chair. She's also earned recognition in Total Food Service's Top Women in Metro New York Food Service and Hospitality, a well-deserved place in the Heritage Radio Network's Hall of Fame. So join us today as we talk about tips for starting a career in food PR, how networking can elevate your career, and much, much more. And there she is. Good morning. Can I tell you, I'm exhausted after that intro. Oh, my Lord. There's a lot there.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're smiling, so it brings back memories, all that stuff. Huh? What a career. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah. My career kind of happened by accident in a sense, but here I am, and I've done a lot. So thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Sometimes the best things in the world happen by accident, right? I have to comment on the beautiful background. So are you in your home studio this morning?
Yes, my home studio in Manhattan.
This is your pass, right? You're at the pass this morning in your own
restaurant. If you need anything, let me know. I do have coffee going.
I bet you do. Yeah, so before we dive in, and there's so much, ironically enough, I was just in New York, partly for work, partly for play, just last week, and we had a blast, and we did the restaurant thing. I'm just really curious, where do you sit in New York? How long have you been in New York? And how spoiled are New Yorkers by the wealth of amazing food?
Yes, we are. I've been in New York since 1998. So I've been here 25 years. You know, sometimes I think about moving and I don't know where to go because there's no place like New York. So
it really isn't, right?
I'm here. I love living in the city and I'm in Manhattan and it's great. One of the things amazing about Manhattan or just New York is that you can walk everywhere. And a lot of times my nights or days become a little more spontaneous because you're walking around and you notice new restaurants or bars or things opening and you might even pop in. So the accessibility of that. And as someone who dines out all the time, loves to dine out, I can't get to all the restaurants because there's new ones constantly opening. And then it's the places that I love that I just haven't been to, I realized, in 5 years. And I'm like, oh, I have to get back there because we do have an abundance of amazing restaurants and choices. So we are spoiled.
And some of those restaurants, I'll pick on one in particular in a very good way, Gramercy Tavern. Gosh, I didn't even realize that Michael Anthony was still there. It seems like he's been there for so long. And whether you sit in the back or you sit in the tavern, you know, it's just electric. It's exciting. And so we went last week. I think we were there Thursday night. And Sherry, I can't begin to tell you what a small world it is. And we'll talk about this a little bit more. You and I just met last September at the Roots Conference in Ohio with Farmer Lee. And I'm so glad that we did. And so we're at Gramercy. We're up front. We have a great seat. And, I don't know why, but we had a great table, just a great table. Everything was happening around
us. I don't think there's a bad table. That's
yeah, you're right. You're right. And it was packed. It was just packed, as always. And our server was phenomenal. Her name was Alexis. She was really chatty with the kids and all that. And then we started talking to sommelier a little bit. And it all came about because we talked about, hey, we're from Boulder, we're going home tomorrow. And, Alexis let us know that, one of my colleagues has to go to Boulder for something tomorrow. You know, let me bring him over. He happens to be the sommelier. We talk for a while, and it turns out he's a graduate of my little school here in Boulder, Colorado.
Small world.
Right. And, you know, so then the conversation took on, you know, a life of its own. And I say some of that to sort of set up really the first part of our chat here, this idea of, you know, dining out and travel and, you know, the serendipitous, spontaneous things that happen. I so love following your, you know, your social media, your solo travel, and your dining content on Instagram, which you really fell in love with after I met you in September. And I imagine, I'm not, but I imagine many are intimidated. I love the idea of it. But I imagine many are intimidated by this idea of solo adventuring. So could you first define for our audience what that is, what that means, and how long has that been a thing? And what appeals to you the most about solo adventuring?
Yes. Well, thank you. And before I just get into that, I have to say, though, I went back to Gramercy Tavern over the holidays, and I went with a friend because it also the decor there, it's so warm and welcoming and festive, and it's just such an amazing restaurant, and Michael Anthony's and the whole team's amazing. So I recently went back there. I got the burger, like the whole tavern
part of it
fine. So that was one, because I do tend to focus a little more on the new places. And I mean, I'm glad I got back and I'm glad you visited. So
absolutely. And it's so beautiful in the holidays.
Yeah.
Oh, during
it is. And
yeah.
They have the hospitality thing down for,
they do
perfectly.
They
so,
do. Yeah.
But solo dining, so I think it was probably like, I don't know, a dozen or more years ago where I worked for myself. I love to travel. I love restaurants. I'm single. And I just realized I can travel and see the world and just go. And I can work from anywhere. So I just started traveling more. And the more I traveled and by myself, I just really embraced it. And I was always traveling to check out restaurants and dining places solo, and living in New York too, just going out I have friends, I do make plans with people, but it's very easy to just show up by yourself as a walk-in or make a reservation by yourself. If I decide I want to go to a new restaurant, I could just make the reservation, go. You don't have to like go to the back and forth and making plans. So I just started dining out more by myself. And the more I did it, the more I really just embraced it. I feel when you're by yourself at a restaurant, I don't feel lonely. You're surrounded by people. You can be as social in a sense as you want. You could sit at the bar. You can be chatty with your neighbors, or you can sit and just be quiet by yourself and enjoy the experience of the food, the service, what you're there for. And so when people tell me I'm brave for dining out by myself, I never get it, because it's like, it's not being brave. It's just showing up and just taking in the experience, which is there for us to enjoy. And there's just, so I'm a big cheerleader of it. And I think people who follow me know that, but I don't do it for any reason other than I love restaurants and I love going out and I love meeting people too. I've met people all around the world in restaurants a lot, because when you're solo, you also are more open to those conversations with other people, and you're not just focused on the person or the people you're with.
I love that. It's super genuine. It's not just about nourishment. It's about the experience as well. So to your point, you're watching what's happening. Do you prefer, or is it, you know, different depending on your mood, to sit at the bar and get into great conversations with, you know, people sitting around there, maybe doing the same thing you are? Or do you like to sit in the dining room and kind of watch the majesty?
I like it all. It depends on my mood. Sometimes it depends on the restaurant. I mean, I like bars sometimes. Sometimes I like sitting just at the table. I mean, I've done fine dining, white tablecloth restaurants. I've done a lot of tasting menus by myself, which I think are amazing. And I highly recommend them to people, because a tasting menu restaurant, there's a lot happening. It's like theater, really. It's like
It really is. Yeah.
You're being, you know, new dishes are coming. Chefs are coming out of the kitchen sometimes and explaining the dishes to you. And you can really focus on the food and the experience. And yeah, most people don't think about doing a long tasting menu by themselves, but I highly recommend it.
I love it. What about 24? So we're just getting started in this year. Do you have a specific agenda for this year of, you know, I've got to get here and I've got to fly down to DC, or I got to get see what's happening in Miami? Or are you very spontaneous about that and just kind of let it come to you?
It's a little of both. I mean, as much as I travel, I feel I have like so many places I want to go that I haven't been to or want to get back to. I mean, some of my travel for this year, I know coming up, is centered around culinary and hospitality events that I know I want to go to, like the James Beard Awards in Chicago, or the World's 50 Best is going to Las Vegas in June. So I'm hoping to go to that. I did go last year to 50 Best in Valencia, which was really exciting. And then I ended up going to Rio for the Latin America's 50 Best. And those were, wow. I had William Drew from 50 Best on my show before the awards, and I always wanted to go. So it was sort of, I made the ask, like, as I was covering it for my podcast, it was like planned, but not planned. And so I think when I'm having opportunities to go places, I'm seizing them because I'm sort of like, why not? This is what I love to do. So some of it's planned and some of it's more spontaneous. I don't have 2024 mapped out at all, but I know like in June, like those two events are happening. So we'll see if I can make both of them.
No, I love it. Where's the exciting place to go in Chicago these days? That's where I'm from originally. It's where I was born and raised. So when I, you know, read about your time at Charlie Trotter's, I have one of his menus from 1991 right down here. It's not hanging. It's on the ground there. And I think he was there 25 years or so, but I had a restaurant in the mountains of Colorado in those years. And, you know, there was no internet. There wasn't a direct way to understand what chefs were doing unless you got magazines like Food and Wine and Gourmet, or you went to the restaurants, right? So I picked up the phone and I called Charlie Trotter's. And at the time I was young and I liked to put menus of different chefs in the restaurant and preferably have dined there, but not always. Anyway, somebody lovely answered the phone there. And yeah, you know, 2 weeks later, because it was snail mail, right? I got a beautiful package in the mail with two menus. One was the first all vegetarian menu that I never even thought of something like that, but he had it in 91. That one I have since gifted to Farmer Lee, by the way. Nice. And then the other one that I held on to. And then, you know, in years after that, I had the opportunity to dine there a few times, but I was so touched by the fact that they picked up the phone, they listened to what I said, they put the menus, Charlie signed the menus, Keep On Cooking, Charlie Trotter, and shipped him off to Who Was I, right? This young restaurateur. So it's always kind of stayed with me. So, you know, when I read all about your history at Charlie Trotter's, and we'll get to that in a minute, I'm super curious of what gets you excited about the Chicago food scene. Because back then, Chicago wasn't a food scene. You know, Charlie Trotter, you know, was one of the first to really put Chicago on the map.
True. I mean, I lived there in after college, 95 to 98. And then I moved here in 98. So it was 3 years there. And I lived Wrigleyville and Lakeview. And I worked at Rock Bottom Brewery. I worked at BW3 as a bar manager. And I worked at Charlie Trotter's at like the high end of serving. And I don't know if you know this, I was a garmage cook at a jazz club called Green Dolphin Street. That was like my last job before moving here. So I tested those waters. But to your point, there wasn't a West Loop.
And
the last time when I was there last year for the James Beard Awards, I stayed at the Hoxton in the West Loop. And it was like, it's thriving. And there's so many restaurants, and Blackbird is the restaurant that opened, like, I think it was 98, right when I was leaving, that put that area kind of on the map. And this last time I was there, I went back to Avec, which just celebrated its, I think, 20-year mark. And so I mean, those, I mean, as far as those, I mean, one-off hospitality group and the Boca restaurant group, I mean, and like Au Chevelle, like those guys with hog salt. Like Chicago's interesting because it has like, Let Us Entertain You. Like it has like those few, there's like four or five like big restaurant groups that kind of have a lot of the restaurants. And then there's one-off. I'm excited to go because I mean, there's places I'm trying to think like Doug Saltis has a new place that I'd like to check out. There's a place called Indian that I haven't been to. There's a lot. And I'm sure there's going to be more in the next couple months.
I love it. I love it. And we have a good friend in Curtis Duffy who's found great success in Chicago over the years. And he's a wonderful person. So let's really get into the restaurant scene a little bit. 30 years experience or more. Did you, Sherry, always know that you needed to, you went to the University of Michigan, congratulations. Did you?
Oh, go blue.
Go blue. Did you always know that you needed to be part of the restaurant scene? Was this in your DNA? Was your family really big about dining around the table?
Well, my family, we did have my parents, I mean, my love of restaurants and the hospitality industry and everything I do didn't come from mom and dad, even though we did a family meal and, you know, we ate together every night when we could. And that was important as a family. And my mom's a good cook, but she has to follow a recipe to the T. She's like, she will not venture off of a recipe and keeps it simple.
And that's okay. That's safe. Way to go, mom. She's up.
It is. But my parents are not restaurant people. I mean, they're like me. When I go down to Miami, which is where I'm from, they're so supportive and love doing things I like to do. So they like to go to restaurants when I come down. But I'm the one who's making the reservations and saying, this is where we're going to go. But I've always been a worker and someone who's just driven. And so I got my first job when I was 16, as soon as I could drive, at a Mexican restaurant in Miami as a hostess, because I just wanted to, I don't know, I was drawn to the industry back then. I had summer jobs at Bennigan's and Chili's, and I just always worked and on the side, even when I was in school, and was passionate about being in around restaurants. So I went to Michigan and I didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated, or even the 4 years I was there. I thought it was important to get a degree and like a well-balanced education. And also just there's one thing, the books and the academic part of school, but it's also the social part. And I mean, Michigan, I loved going to school there because we had the football, we had the culture, we just had a lot going on. It was a beautiful campus to be on Ann Arbor, and we had Zingerman's.
Yes.
So after college, I moved to Chicago and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I was drawn to restaurants. So I kind of, as I said, like it was kind of accidental, my whole career, how it's turned about. But when I was in Chicago, I decided I wanted to go to cooking school because I had a moment where I thought I wanted to be a chef. And so I did a 6-month culinary program in Chicago. And that was right before I got hired at Charlie Trotter's, because Trotter's came about because I had his book. Like, I didn't have many books back then, cookbooks, but I had his beautiful book. And I remember just flipping through it and being like, how do you make these dishes? This is art. So I ended up going in there and interviewing to be a server, front of the house person. And I had more experience front than back. So I got hired. And that was like grad school for me in the culinary arts.
That's great.
So it wasn't planned. I actually thought I was going to go to Europe and cook. Like, that was my idea. But I ended up at Charlie Trotter's, and I'm very happy and proud that I did, because it was an amazing experience.
Yeah, 100%. I don't know a ton of detail. Last time I talked to the farmer, it looked like Charlie's son was going to try to take a run at reopening. I don't know if that's happened yet, but I imagine that'll be a very emotional time in the city of Chicago if he gets that off the ground.
Yeah, and there's so many people that came from, I mean, Mitch Duffy and just people, I don't know. There's a lot of people I know in New York now, like John Winterman and Marcus Glocker. Like John, like they weren't there when I was there. I just missed John. But it's like we have this connection because the history of working there.
Yeah. So fast forward then a little bit. You earned your BA from the University of Michigan, went to culinary school, or grad school, as you put it. I love that. At what point did you decide that food PR was your way forward?
So I moved to New York in 1998, and I started in NYU's food studies program, which was in its second year at the time. And again, I still really didn't know exactly what I wanted to do with my career, but it was a great opportunity to be a part of that program. And it made some introductions to me, like Mitchell Davis was one of my teachers, and he with the James Beard Foundation. He was with them for a long time. And I got a connection to James Beard through that. And I was like recipe testing for them for their newsletter for a little while. And I dabbled in food styling, and I was a little all over the place. And then I ended up in 2000 getting an opportunity to work at a PR company that mostly did restaurant PR. And that was when I had the aha moment of, oh, this is maybe what I can do with my career. I can work with restaurants and chefs and help promote them and get their message out there. But I don't necessarily have to be the one cooking or running my own restaurant. So, and at that time, we worked with Bobby Flay and Todd English and opened Tao and Sushi Samba and Lotus, which was a thriving club bar lounge, very happening place in the meatpacking district that lasted a very long run for a bar lounge. And it was very exciting. So I learned PR on the job. I never studied it. It was just one of those things that doing it, and PR is a lot about relationships. And so I've been working for myself now for 20 years and doing PR, and my contacts are very strong in the food and restaurant based because I've been in it for a long time and I go to lots of events and meet people. But it's like when you first start out, you have to get yourself out there and meet people and just start networking, because I don't know how you teach that except for doing it. So PR is something like I learned from doing.
I love that. And if I could say, to embarrass you a little bit, you just glow talking. I mean, you could see your smile and your face just lights up when you talk about the industry. Part of me, Sherry, thinks that's a gift. I don't know how you teach someone to love what they do as you clearly do, as much as you do. And so then in 2003, you launch your own PR firm, you know, obviously generating publicity for quality chefs, restaurants, products, that sort of thing. Can you, for those who are not familiar with the PR space, you've touched on it a little bit, but what would the elevator speech be? What is the mission or the mission statement or the vision of a PR expert like yourself?
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. And I don't know what it is about restaurants or being a part of this industry that I love, but it's in me. And I don't know if you could teach that.
Well, it's in this too. I mean, it comes, and you know, on every page, yeah. You know, it's, And I know a lot of it's from the people you talk to, but you don't get to put a book together like this without putting in 20 years of work like you did, smiling and shaking hands and doing the hard work like Denzel Washington always says, you know, see you at work, right? So, and I get passionate about this a little bit because we have a lot of students that come our way with, whether online or in Austin or in Boulder, that were probably very much like you back in the day when you went to school and like, what do I really want to do? And today, 2024, you know, people are looking for other avenues. They don't all want to be behind the stove. They know they can't. Some want to be in the front of the house, but some are probably fascinated by the idea of being connected to the industry in a similar way that you are. Supporting it, loving it, smiling about it, glowing about it. So to me, and it was one of the main reasons I really wanted to chat with you, is to just, you know, better understand like how exciting this career really is. Not downplaying the hard work. That's obvious. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And PR, I mean, PR is, I wouldn't say like, it's not an easy job. It's about relationships, which I touched on. PR is basically the middleman between the person you're working with or representing and your client and the media, and being the connector and the person who can, you know, I still put together press releases and fact sheets and all that when I work with a new client, because it's like putting together your information packet about the concept, and then it's sending it and reaching out to the people who might want to tell the story of the restaurants or the chefs or the products or whatever you're working with. I mean, I stick with culinary and hospitality PR. I've worked mostly with restaurants. Those have been my clients. I've done a few products or a few events, but I stick with that because my relationships are in the food and beverage space. But it's a matter of it really, you're, as we said, you're like the middleman. So I think communication is a big part of PR, like having good communication with your client, whether that's emailing or texting or whatever, however you can get the information. And because when there's opportunities to be a part of a story, or when someone from a TV station wants to come in and cover your opening, like you have to be able to set all that up and communicate back and forth between the chef, let's say, or the owner and the media. So it's about making those connections, and you can't control, like you can't guarantee press. Advertising is different than PR, because advertising, you can buy an ad in a paper and you know you can write the copy, you know exactly what it's going to look like. PR is you're relying on editorial coverage or reviews, which you don't know what you're going to get. But when you get that endorsement from a reviewer or from a writer, it has a lot of value. So if any PR person tells you, I can guarantee you I will get you a New York Times review with that, you don't even have to say how many stars, they really can't, because we don't know. But you can say, you can show your past record, and I've worked with these clients before, and the New York Times has written about them or covered them. So yeah, that's one thing. It's a little uncertain what you're going to get, but I have to work with people and concepts I believe in, because as you've pointed out, like I'm genuinely, I love what I do, but I can't tell someone something's great if I don't think it's great. Like it's just not, it won't work for me. So I stick with working with people that are good people who I admire, who are doing great things.
How big of a role does networking, trusted networking, play in all of that? I imagine to secure a, let's say, prestigious client, right? A well-known client. I imagine referrals are like the, you know, the best thing in the world. Same in our business. That's free advertising when you get a beautiful referral, right?
Yeah. Well, most of my business, I have to say, does now come through referrals, because I've been around for a while and I'm a small company. I mean, I'm really mostly a one-woman show, or really a one-woman show that I've hired freelancers along the way, but I didn't grow into a big company because I like doing the work and I like having the relationships. So I don't need that many clients to keep me busy. And referrals are big and networking is big. I mean, I like networking. I like being social. I mean, I think during the pandemic, that was challenging because that was taken away from us. That's the social aspect of everything that I do and we do. And I think people really realize the value and why they, even if they don't dine out maybe as much as I do or go to as many events, but they realize how important being social was in our lives and socializing. So I have always gone to lots of events and gone to festivals and conferences around the country because I love doing it. But it's a way that I've met lots of people. And going back to solo dining or being solo, most of the events and things I've gone to, I go to solo. So when you're walking around and you're, you know, you end up meeting other people and chit-chatting and making connections, which I think is how I've gotten to know a lot of people.
I love that response, and thank you for that. It's really good advice, particularly for students, because, you know, we try to work on their soft skills or power skills, as they call it today, so that they can advocate for themselves when they're out there in the industry, right? So networking is really important. Now, you started to mention challenges, the pandemic in particular. I'm curious, given the dynamic and, you know, competitive food scene in New York City, let's say, what would you say are some of the most unique challenges that someone in your position faces when they're promoting, let's say, chefs or restaurants or concepts? And kind of a second part to that, how do you navigate those challenges outside of the pandemic, let's say?
Well, I think the fact that you can't guarantee what you're going to get. You don't know. And sometimes clients' expectations, you know, mean they're hiring you to publicize their restaurant and to get the word out. So managing expectations and just being a sounding board for people, I think you have to be, you know, be there. But I think being real, I'm always realistic with my pitching and my approach. Kind of, I pitch what makes sense, at least to me, what I think opportunities where, like, I'm not going to pitch a chef to be on TV if they're not, they don't want to do TV or they're not comfortable on TV. So you have to think every client's different, which is also, I think, great and cool, because even though there's a little bit of a formula with PR of, let's say you put together press materials and you reach out to the press, and but every client's different, has a different story to tell. So you really have to get to know or understand what's special about them and why people want to tell their story. And I'll also add, though, that like when I started, there wasn't social media. That's been a game changer in PR marketing, and marketing ties into public relations as well. I mean, I call my company Bayer Public Relations, but I've always done marketing too, because it's like events and just it's just a lot of crossover. But social media is a big part of being in communications now, and I think Instagram is the main, I'd say, social media outlet that the industry has embraced, or most of the chefs are now on, because they realize you can do it on your own, and you can, in a sense, control the messaging getting out there and share what your food looks like in your menus. I mean, if you go back to the days of when I was at Trotter's, like, if you wanted to know what Charlie Trotter's food looked like, you had to go to his restaurant, or you could buy one of his beautiful books, but you couldn't just, he wasn't putting up images.
No. You know, it's interesting that you say that. I was just, my next question was going to be, since 2003, when you got into the business, how has the landscape of PR changed to today, right? And so social media is obviously at the top of that podium. For those, Sherry, interested in pursuing a career, again, understanding how hard the work is, are there any like specific or unique steps that they could take to set themselves up? Is it an advertising degree that would be helpful, a marketing degree that would be helpful, a culinary grad degree, as you said? I love that, totally stealing that. That would help them. I mean, obviously, PR encompasses many different, you know, genres and fields and stuff, but specifically in our space, you know, food.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a general liberal arts degree is great. I mean, my degree at University of Michigan was organizational studies, which was a little bit of everything. And actually, when I was working on my book, I was like, organizational skills was like a big part of putting the book together, like being organized. But it touched on a lot of different, you know, from business to philosophy and just like basic liberal arts education, which I think is good. I mean, I think you can study PR, you can study marketing, communications. I mean, those are all amazing degrees out there. But I think getting in the field and doing internships or just like getting work experience is really important. And I love that I did a 6-month culinary program, because even though I didn't become a chef, or I can relate. I have some knowledge about what a mother sauce is, or, you know, mise en place, and what it takes to create beautiful dishes and run a kitchen and all that. So I think getting hands-on experience, and if you're looking to get into the culinary space, even if you're not thinking of being a chef, I think doing a culinary program, I would totally advise it. And I love the hands-on experience too. I mean, it was exciting for me. So
that's the best part of it. That's the best part.
Yeah.
Since we're chatting today in a podcast, I'd love to ask, we've been doing, you know, The Ultimate Dish for about 3 years, and I feel like I'm always learning, particularly when I chat with like experienced and knowledgeable people like yourself. You launched in 2014, All in the Industry, and people behind the scenes, or people don't realize the work that goes on behind the scenes, as I'm sure you do, as I do, I try to get as prepared as I can, right, for a show, out of respect for the guests And out of general curiosity, just so that we could have a great conversation, right? I'm truly interested in the topic, in the subject, right? In learning. But you, I mean, you've released, I think it's 350 episodes already, right? That's three times. Almost four times as many as we've launched over. And quite honestly, I always joke with our marketing team. It's like, yeah, I landed in this seat because I drew the shortest straw. But no, it was an idea. Let's do a podcast. Let's talk to thought leaders and just really interesting people about the industry. And, you know, and I thought, okay, that'll be cool. We'll do a few episodes and then you'll be tired of me. And here we are going into 24 and, it's gaining steam, but 350 episodes. I don't even know if Dax Shepard has done that many episodes, but it feels like you, I don't have the years down perfectly, but isn't that right about the time where this medium really took off? I mean, people really started listening to podcasts.
Well, first, I'd like to say, if I forget to say, I'll be angry at myself. Like, I'm so honored to be on your show. Like, your show's amazing. And
it's,
thank you for
having
me.
Fun, and, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And your prep and your interest and all that, I really appreciate it. So yesterday, on Facebook, I opened Facebook up and it shares memories with you sometimes.
Yeah.
The picture pops up. And the picture pops up yesterday from January 8th, 2014, when I did, of me and Stephen Kamali. And it says, like, all smiles after our first live show.
Oh,
so
my God.
Yesterday was the 10th anniversary of me podcasting. And so I reposted that picture.
You should. The chills that I just got by hearing you say that are just absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
10 years. Wow. What was it like at the beginning? I'm totally getting off topic, but what was it like in 2014 when you called somebody up and said, hey, I want you to be on my show? Like, did people even know what it was? What a leap of faith.
So I was at the 10-year mark with my PR company, and I was looking for something to do. What else can I be doing? So that's when I came up with the idea for my show of All in the Industry, Behind the Scenes Talent and Hospitality, because I knew a lot of people in the industry from networking that did different things than what I did, whether they designed restaurants or they did the cocktail program. So that was how my idea came about. And I reached out to Heritage Radio Network, which they started their radio network of podcasting 5 years earlier. And they only had a few shows, but I knew a few people who had them. And so I reached out to them and then got the opportunity to do a show. And I've just been at it since, and one of the longest running now. But back then, I mean, there weren't podcasting now. There's so many podcasts out there. It's really, I think during the pandemic, a lot of people created podcasts too. They realized that was something they could be doing. And people, you know, everyone has their phone and likes listening to, it's easy to listen to things when you're walking around doing other things. So podcasting, I think, has become really hot in the past couple of years. But when I started, there were podcasts, but it just wasn't as popular. And I did my show live at the beginning too. I went out to Bushwick in the backyard of Roberta's are two shipping containers. They're still there. And I still go out sometimes to do my show. But back at the beginning, I went out every week, Wednesdays at 4 o'clock, and recorded it. And it went live. So I still record my show like it's live. I might do some mild editing here and there, but it was very nerve-wracking. I mean, I remember how nervous I was the first, probably at least the first 50 shows. And I still get a little nervous. I mean, I think that's a part of it. But I was like, it was very nerve-wracking at the beginning, because it was like this thing was going to go out there to the airwaves and you couldn't fix it, you know?
So similar to the way we do it, we're talking live here, but obviously we'll doctor it up here or there when I have to cough or something like that. So people get a different version sometimes. That's why we like to sometimes keep it running when we're just chatting, even off.
Right.
You know, because sometimes some of the best stuff that you talk about is unplanned, right? So can
all
you,
of it.
Yeah. So then in 2019, fast forward, you started all. Is this a different multimedia company or new media company? or production
with
company.
All the industry?
Yeah, all the, yeah.
So I'm glad you brought it up because I often forget to mention it, which is crazy. Back in, I guess it was 2018 or 19, I came up with the idea to do a conference based on my podcast. So I did a conference right before the pandemic. It was in January 2020, and it was called HOST, which stands for Hospitality Operations Services and Technology. So, and that was to basically based on my podcast of bringing it to life, bringing people together to have these conversations. And so I created All in the Industry LLC, like the company, because I was branching out and doing the podcast, you know, and I had the conference. So that's how that came about. And it was amazing. Farmer Lee came.
Yeah, of course. What an amazing person. That's awesome.
He flew in for it. And it was a full day of programming we did at the William Vale in Brooklyn and Williamsburg. And it was, I did a one-on-one conversation with Drew Neuport. We had, I mean, it was.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. I had Glenn Coben and Jimmy Huey. They're like, one does kitchen design and one does front of the house design of restaurants. And I had them in conversations. Like I curated the whole program. There were some panel talks and it was really amazing. But people asked me if I'm going to bring it back. And I thought it would be an annual thing. But as I said, it was January 2020. And you know, it happened in March. Yeah. And I've been meaning to bring it back. And I hope to. But when I was working on the book, I was like, I can't, because the book was as big of an undertaking as a conference. And I'm already doing PR and a podcast. I couldn't add in like a fourth thing at the same time.
Well, we're going to see each other at the end of the month in New York. But what a cool collaboration that could be. Stranger things have happened. Sherry Bear and Escoffier, that we could bring it back. That would be a lot of fun.
We should talk because it's cool that I have the, you know, first year of doing an event and you don't know what you're going to get, or I'd never done a conference before. And the fact that it was well received and people are asking me if I'm bringing it back is amazing. The thing with me is, as I mentioned, I'm a worker and I love what I do working, but I'm still like, I need a little support here and there. So if you're planning to do a conference, I'll tell anyone listening, it's a lot of work.
I thought
it was going to be a lot of work, but it was even more than I thought.
And especially if you want to do it at the level that you probably did it, right? To quality and perfection. And speaking of perfection, we're probably going long, but I have a lot more to talk about. If you can hang, I can hang.
I can. I'm sorry if I'm talking too long.
No, I love it. I love it. Let's talk a little bit about this little gem here. Life lessons from leading chefs around the world. You know, and it doesn't take much to see very quickly words of wisdom from Dominique Crenn, Massimo Bottura, Jeremy Chan, Eric Rivera, Claire Smith, Alice Waters. And by the way, you know, they'll probably edit this out, but my wife has made it really clear to me that she would leave me for Dominique Crenn in a heartbeat. And I don't blame her. We love her book as well. But
I love her energy.
And it's such a beautiful story, right? And the reverence and love that she has for her father, her family is, it's just beautiful. But getting back to Sherry, through your writing, you've had this unbelievable opportunity to explore the lives and experiences of various chefs. And again, some of it, gotta buy the book. I bought the book for many of my chefs.
Thank you.
You bet. Everybody loves it. Can you share any particular insights, revelations that you gained about the culinary world, this world that you love, this space that you love, and maybe even the challenges that chefs face, or even better, the broader cultural impact of their work, which has changed over time? Are there any stories, Sherry, or profound moments that have impacted you as a professional, as an author, let's say? There's a lot there. That's a big question, so unfair. Is there something that stands out?
The book was such a dream project for me to work on. I mean, I obviously love chefs and being a part of this industry, and the fact that I got to collaborate with chefs who I admire all around the world and get their advice. And there's so much advice in the book. I mean, I know it's my book, but it's one of these. I think one thing about the book, which just to note, is it's not even a book you need to or even advise maybe to read cover to cover. Like, you could just pick it up and read like a quote. There's some pull quotes in it, and there's 14 chapters, and there aren't recipes. It's more business, life, lesson-y type of a book. And what was cool, or one of the things cool about it, was chefs who I was reaching out to are all around the world, whether they were in Dubai or Singapore or Los Angeles. There was a lot of consistency in a sense of talking about how important teamwork is, or leadership and mentorship, or work-life balance, or how hard it is. I mean, nobody in the book said it was easy or this was a career you should do just to make lots of money and be famous. Like, everyone said, like, it's hard. You got to pay your dues. You really, you know, you got to do it because you're passionate about it. And nobody was an overnight success, you know, like even a Massimo Bottura. Like, people think now these people are so famous and well-known and have restaurants around the world and are on 50 best lists, and like that you think they just have been there forever, but they haven't. And people talk about the struggles in the book and the failures. And even, I mean, Rodolfo Guzman of Barrago in Santiago, which that was a spontaneous trip I took last year to go visit him before his spring menu was ending, because he's like, why don't you come now? I'm like, okay. So I flew out there to experience his menu, and he's in the book. And he was just, I mean, and I've interviewed him on my podcast as well. Like, I mean, talking about really, he was like not, the restaurant wasn't doing well. And then he got a break, like he got on a list and things changed. And so a lot of chefs talked about really how hard it is, and that you have to do it because you're passionate, and just to keep going and surround yourself with good people. And I'll just share too, this is my one special book that I've been carrying around with me. I was at the awards when I was there, and I got a lot of the signatures of the chefs in the book.
Oh, that's great.
And when I'm going to their restaurant, I'm like finding their page in the book and getting them to sign. And so we'll see. I think I have about 30 signatures at this point. So I got another.
Brilliant. That's you took what?
To go.
Well, you took a concept, right? I could remember years ago when I was traveling around a lot more, and, you know, and I have a few of these journals, right? And when I ran into somebody that I admired, I had them sign that journal, right? And sometimes they wrote a couple of things and sometimes they didn't. But this book sort of took care of that for a lot of us. One of my favorites, I mentioned I went to the University of Oregon, so I spent some time in Portland as well. So Naomi Pomeroy, she said, as you know, get to know and really be honest about your strengths and weaknesses. I've sent this out to my team on a couple of different occasions, giving Naomi credit, of course. I think Beast is closed now, but that was a restaurant that was, you know, like Le Pigeon in the day, that was an unbelievable experience. It's almost like she was angry in the kitchen. She was just so passionate in her food.
I got to go once because I went out to Portland for a feast. It was a culinary conference that they did that was really wonderful. I got to dine there once and meet her. I mean, not all the chefs in the book, I'd been to their restaurant or met them, but Naomi's someone who I knew from going to events. I mean, actually, a lot of chefs I knew from events, which is why I think going to events is putting yourself out there. You never know what's going to come of it. Because when I was at the time or meeting her, I didn't think one day I would be reaching out to her and be like, hey, do you want to be a part of my book?
Yeah.
But I did.
Networking, right? Right. This is kind of an interesting question. I didn't think about this until right now. I was going to ask you if you believe that it's critical for young chefs, but let's just say young people who are trying to find their way to have a mentor from the start. And I guess the second part of that is, did you have a mentor when you decided to do what you wanted to do in life?
Actually, not really. I mean, I feel like there's been people who have given me advice and been sounding boards over the years, and certainly you know, I haven't gotten here on my own without people supporting me. But I'm not a person who's can really say, oh, I like this particular person I give all the credit to, but not to say, I think it's lots of people. And I think mentorship is important. If you can find, you got to find someone that you trust and believes in you and you believe in them. And I think you can learn a lot from someone else. And me and I was, I think it's cool in the book, Claudia Fleming and Tom Colicchio are both in the book. And Claudia talks about Tom being her mentor or someone she learned things from along the way. So I guess it's, I don't think there's like a one size fits all for anyone. I'm a very self-contained or like I'm a self-doer. I don't know how you put it. Like I tend to do most things on my own and not even tell people until like I just share it with the world. And so that's my personality. But I think getting people that you trust and admire of what they do. But actually, I will say one of the jobs I had, it was before PR, was I did an internship at Food Arts magazine and got a little experience in the publishing side of things. And Michael Batterbury, he's someone I would cite as, you know, a bit of a mentor, as someone I really admired. And we'd have team meetings and he would actually, I was just an intern and he would like look to me and be like, what do you think about this? And like really cared to know my opinion and like have a conversation. So, and he was amazing. I mean, he passed many years ago, but I feel really lucky I got the opportunity to work with him as well.
No, that's so well said. Thanks for bringing that up and dating myself as well. When Food Arts came out, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. Right?
I mean, such an amazing magazine.
Couldn't wait for the episodes or the issues to come. Art de Culinaire is a little bit like that these days as well. But Sherry, how can listeners stay in touch with you? This, I do have another one last question, but we have to be able to plug you for sure. If you want to share your Instagram handle or any way that listeners and viewers can connect.
Sure. Well, I have a bunch of websites. I have BayerPublicRelations.com. SherryBayer.com and allintheindustry.com. And then I'm on social media at Sherry Bayer, at Bayer PR, and at All Industry. So I'm mostly on Instagram where you can find me, but I'm on LinkedIn. I mean, I'm very Googleable.
You're Googleable. And when we edit and push this out, we'll add all of those tags as well so that people can find you. But before I let you sneak out of here, and thank you so much for your precious time today. The name of this little podcast is The Ultimate Dish, so I can't let you go until you tell me, in your mind, it could be a memory, but I can't wait because you probably dine more than most. What is the ultimate dish?
This is the hardest question.
It's a tough question. It
is. Because I have been really spoiled and I've eaten very well and I continue to, and I'm very lucky. I'm very grateful. And all the chefs, so generous in their hospitality. It just like fills me up. But I was thinking about this, like, how can I answer this question? And I'll say one of the ultimate dishes, which I recently had, was I went back to Barney Greengrass on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I actually had a deconstructed bagel and lox, so I could kind of put it together myself. But I think bagel and lox is like the ultimate dish that I would go to at any time for comfort food and just something I really enjoy. So
I think that is a perfect ultimate. No one's said that before.
Really?
And having just come from New York, where I think truly introduced our kids to bagels and lox, true bagels and lox. And the timing couldn't be more perfect for that. I love it. Bagels and lox.
Yeah, it's awesome. Also, Russ and Daughters in New York City. I mean, we talk about amazing restaurants in New York, but like, yeah, we have the bagel and lox thing we have down here. So I recommend it for a visit.
So you said the word deconstructed. How was that deconstructed?
It was a platter or a smaller platter. So it was like the bagel, the cream cheese, the lox, and I wanted sable fish, which is one of the reasons why I got it that way. So I got the sable. And then I got a side of capers and it had the, you know, tomato, onion, lettuce. So you could just make your own sandwich, which, but you can also go there and say, I want an everything bagel, you know, with lox or Nova and what cream cheese, and they'll make it for you. Made it myself.
I love it. Sherry, thank you so much for the time. I'm so appreciative. You're delightful. You're a breath of fresh air. I can't wait to see you later in the month in New York City when we celebrate Michelle Escoffier at the Tin Building and Jean George and the whole crew. And let's stay in touch. I'm gonna bug you about that idea.
Thank you. And congratulations on everything you've accomplished. And I hope to get out to Boulder one of these days and visit you there.
Welcome anytime. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ultimate Dish Podcast, brought to you by Auguste Escoffier School of Culinary Arts. Visit escoffier.edu/podcast to find any materials mentioned during the podcast, including notes, links, and other resources. And if you can, please leave us a rating on Apple or Spotify and subscribe to support our show. This helps us reach more aspiring individuals ready to take the next step toward their dream careers. Thanks for listening.